For many of us, we've been taught that our ego is something to be banished, overcome, avoided, and dissolved. To be egotistical is to be self-serving and potentially ignorant of others' needs. But Anita Morjani believes there is a difference between being egocentric and embracing our ego as a step towards fulfilling our unique purpose and role in life. She is our guest today on the Uplift Podcast. Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Chip Richards. In 2006, Anita Morjani fell into a coma at the climax of a four-year struggle with cancer. While doctors rushed to attend to her frail body, which was literally in the process of shutting down, and her family prepared in their own ways to say goodbye, Anita entered into a near-death experience and a journey into a completely different state of consciousness. Hours later, instead of dying as doctors were certain that she would do, she regained consciousness, her cancer miraculously healed, and in one of the world's most profound cases of remission, was completely free of disease within weeks. Since then, Anita has heeded the call to share her powerful story as a doorway to help each of us awaken our true purpose and remember our magnificence. She is a deep friend and treasured member of the Uplift community, and she's here with us today for her second appearance on the Uplift Podcast. Welcome, Anita.
Thank you, Chip. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's always just, I always feel a sense of kind of excitement during the day as I know when I know I'm going to be speaking with you. And it feels great to be gathering.
Oh, yeah. And you asked such great questions. I loved the previous one you did. Your questions were beautiful.
Yeah, well, great. And it was so helpful to so many people. And this this conversation really is by, you know, global request as a follow-up. Wow. Because we kind of ended last conversation in a really powerful place where, you know, you shared a very deep perspective around the unique purpose that each one of us has, and that being kind of anchored into being who we are. And so my desire and my hope is that maybe we can dive into that question as an entry into today's conversation and unpack it a bit together.
And sure.
Yeah. I know that's right at the heart of your calling. So I'm thrilled to dive in there with you. And maybe before we do, just for those who aren't as familiar with your story, certainly they'll go back and listen to the first episode that we did together. But is there anything that you'd love to share, just to kind of bring newcomers up to speed with your experience as a you know, kind of a brief doorway into the conversation that we're having?
Well, so if you're a newcomer, I guess the brief version of my story is that February the 2nd, 2006 should have been the last day of my life if the doctors were right, because I was in a coma from end-stage cancer with tumors all over my lymphatic system. Some of the tumors were the size of lemons. I went, but during that coma, I was actually aware of everything that was happening around me, and I feel that I felt myself leaving my body, and I felt amazing when I was no longer attached to my physical body, and I learned a lot from being in that realm. I knew that I was dying, and it felt like I went through the whole dying process. What I have described, experts have said it was a near-death experience. It had a lot of the classic symptoms of a near-death experience where I was greeted by deceased loved ones who were helping me cross over. But the main thing that I think I would want people to know is that I was overcome by a sense of love, a sense of peace, a sense of liberation and freedom, and there was no more pain. There was really no more pain, no pain from the cancer. There was no more fear. I felt incredible. But I also had this deep understanding of who we really are and our purpose here in this life. And our purpose is truly just to be who we are and to love who we are and to express who we are. That's why we come here. But when we come here, we tend to lose our way. I realized I had lost my way and lived in the space of fear that had caused, that had eventually worn me down and drained me to the point of getting cancer. So I understood why I got the cancer. And in that space of understanding, I was given the choice as to whether to come back into my life or not. At first, I didn't want to come back, but my deceased father, whose essence or soul was there guiding me, said to me, or he wanted me to know, that now that I know the truth of who I am, I needed to go back. I needed to come back in my body and live my life fearlessly because it wasn't my time. So I did come back into my body and I healed. My physical body healed very, very rapidly. And since then, and that was 12 years ago, and I have been cancer-free and I have been sharing the things that I learned in the other realm.
Hmm. And just, you know, a little bit of logistics. So how long were you... in earth terms or in regular time, how long were you in the coma? And for you, what length of time did that feel like to be, you know, on the other side or in a different space, connecting with the souls like your father's and getting a view into, you know, the kind of the greater tapestry of your life and life itself?
So I was in that realm in earth terms, not that long. It was about 30 hours. And yet I feel that what I absorbed in those 30 hours, the way it changed me, the way it affected me, impacted me, and completely changed the way I think, if I had to learn in earth time all the things that I learned and absorbed in those 30 hours, it would take me years, you know, to actually... Mm. transform and change to that level as to what happened in just the 30 hours. And the reason is because time in that realm is not linear. And it's like being in a whole different dimension that just changes your understanding, that once you understand it or once you see it or feel it or experience it, you can't undo it. And the metaphor I use to explain that to people is that if you imagine that you were blind your whole life, let's say you were born blind and you've been blind your whole life. And if you've been blind your whole life, you don't even know what color looks like. So when people are describing that something is green or blue or shaded or dark green or light blue or whatever, you have no idea what they're talking about. There's no frame of reference, and you can touch things and feel them. You know, you have very strong tactile senses, very strong sense of taste, very strong sense of smell, because you don't have sight. All these other senses are heightened. But when someone tells you this plate is green and this one is blue, there's no way that your senses are going to help you to determine what color something is, because you don't even know what color is. You don't even know how to measure distance unless you actually walk that distance and count how many steps or how many feet away it is. But you can't look at something like we can look at a wall and say, oh, that's 20 feet away, that's 40 feet away. So things like perspective, there's a lot that is hard to understand, like even the heights of buildings or the fact that there's a blue sky above you and a bird flying. There's like so many things that you won't get. Now, imagine though, and so no matter how much someone tried to teach you, it's hard to completely conceive it. Now, imagine if one day you had the gift of sight. And imagine if you only had sight for one day. In that one day, your world would change. It would completely change, because suddenly you would even understand what it means for a building to have 20 stories or 60 stories. Because unless you can look at a building to see how tall it is, you don't understand what's going on when you step into an elevator and press 20 or 30 or 40. Or two, you know, it's like you're getting into this little room and then you're coming out in a different floor. And how can you even conceive it? And suddenly it all makes sense. The colors make sense. The fact that these two plates may be identical in every way except for the color, it all makes sense. So even if you go back to being blind, you perceive the world around you extremely differently.
Yeah.
Suddenly you understand what going into an elevator means. So now imagine you, if you live in a world where everyone around you is blind and is still blind and has always been blind.
Yeah. But you've come back. I love this metaphor so much because we all have an experience, but it's in that one day of having sight, you suddenly have a totally different view and perspective of the same experience that you've been having all along.
Yes, and a different understanding of it.
Yeah, so please continue. So you come back and everyone else still has no sight.
Yeah, and so you then navigate the world very differently because your understanding of the world is different. But what happens is you're dealing with all the people around you who are, because they all view the world the same way, which is with no sight. Let's say you're in a home for blind people and they all view the world differently. They will be challenging you and saying, no, you're wrong. This is the way it is. Like maybe even something like you get into an elevator and you now understand you're going to a different floor, but their understanding of it is different. It's like, oh, no, we're exiting in a different dimension or something. And you try to explain it to them. They're going to challenge you because they don't understand it. But the thing is, if you had to figure it out without having even that 20 hours, 30 hours, whatever it is of sight, if you had to figure it out, it would take you forever, or maybe you would never figure it out.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, it's almost like, even though, you know, when you have this experience, it's not even the length of time that you're there, but it's just how it changes your perspective of life. And you can never undo it. You can never undo it. And that's the interesting thing. You can never go back to thinking the way you did before. And very often, just if I can just go on and
please,
just say this, people have said to me, has the memory faded? You know, was it like a dream? And I always say, no, the memory hasn't faded. And no, it wasn't like a dream. In fact, life is like a dream. And being in that state was like awakening from the dream. That was the awake state. And the reason it hasn't faded was, number one, because it was like that was the awake state. And number two, when your perspective on, when that experience changes your perspective on life so much that you start walking down life in a different direction from the one you were heading before. It just completely changes the way you view life. And so as time goes by, you've gone further in that new direction. And so you can never go back to living the life that you were living before, or the path you were heading down before. So it never fades. That is always that point in your life that was the turning point that took me down this new path.
Wow. I love that so much. That just lands so deeply. And just the whole notion of the strength of that reference point, be it 30 hours or whatever it was, or whatever it might be for someone, but that the distinction that that moment was the real.
And that was the awake moment.
That was the awake moment. I love that as a beacon that actually then informs everything, you know, almost by default, because now you're plugged into a level of realness and awakeness that would never go away, could never go away.
No, and it can't, because you can prove it to yourself over and over again, you know. And it's just like if somebody, just like if the person was blind their whole life and if they didn't understand certain things, but when they're sighted, it makes sense. And once they have the grasp of it, even when they go back to being blind, they can test those things over and over again. And it still works that way.
Can you give us an example of how that works for you, or how that's worked for you in your life, you know, as you've stepped back into the dream?
Yes, I can absolutely give an example. So, for example, prior to the near-death experience, I used to be reacting to life or reacting to the physical world. I always thought the physical world was the real world. And if I didn't like what was happening, I felt it was my job to change the world, to go out and change the world. And when you can't change the world, you get really stressed out. And the more stressed you get, the more you feel, oh my gosh, I have to work harder to make these changes. And this goes with physical illness as well. I always used to deal with physical illness from the physical. Like, what do I need to change? Do I need to take meds? Do I need to change my diet and take more supplements and research what it is I have? Now, when I was in the near-death state, I realized that my internal world is the real world and my external world is, in other words, I now have what I call an inside-out view of life instead of an outside-in view of life. And I can prove this to myself over and over again, that in actuality, our internal worlds is what drives our external reality and not the other way around, as most of us have been brought up to believe. Of course, people at Uplift and all are very open, and what I'm saying is probably not new to you. But for most people in the world, we really do believe that everything we see and hear, you know, that's happening outside is what's real. But actually, we are creating that all the time with the fear and the stress that we're feeling inside. And the way to change the world is really to go inward. And it's about being at peace internally. It's even with illness, you know, people tend to focus on manipulating the physical. So, for example, people tend to, even if we go, if we don't believe in medicine and drugs, we still tend to go for, oh, let's change our diet, let's take more supplements. It's still on the physical level. With me, what I do nowadays, and this is not what I used to do, what I used to do was, even if I wasn't into taking the prescription drugs and all, it would still have been, oh, I got to do more smoothies, I got to do more juicing, I got to do more this. Now, immediately, the first thing I do is I ask myself, where am I taking on things that are not me? Where am I saying yes when I mean no? What am I taking on that I don't want to take on? So immediately, it's an internal journey.
Yeah. God, there's so much in what you've just shared that we could be here talking all day. But the fundamental notion that you said, and it feels to me like it's, even though there's a great awareness of this, and, you know, certainly in some circles, it feels like potentially one of our greatest crises is that, you know, we think we see the outside world, and we think in order to feel better, I need to fix that thing out there. And once that's different, once that person's different, or that job's different, or that, you know, challenge on the planet is different, then I'll feel better. But we don't realize that actually it's the feeling that we're bringing that's creating that reflection that we're seeing in the first place.
Exactly. And because we're all connected, when you're stressed out and you think that person's behavior is stressing out, is stressing you out, and you're stressed out, your stress is actually contributing to that person's behavior, because actually we're all connected. So let's say you have a kid who's acting up, and I say, oh my God, my kid is stressing me out, but my stress is actually making him or her act up even more. If I had the tools to calm myself down, and to, if I knew how to keep calm, even when my kid is having a tantrum or acting up, the child would calm down, because the child would then get would get my energy, would be feeling in my energy. The child would not be able to have a tantrum within my energetic space if I was calm, because I would be sharing my space with that child.
Hmm. Wow. So in a world that currently seems filled with a lot of contrast, you know, certainly areas of deep consciousness and people devoted to living in one way or another, and an inside out existence, as you've described, and then also systems breaking down, and you know, political arenas deeply filled with conflict and violence in other areas that are, you know, sort of at escalating amounts and out of balance nature, these sorts of things. Where do we find ourselves? How do we be a positive contributing force to that when that energy rises up and says, wow, I want to do something about that?
Yeah, I think I have people have told me my views are somewhat controversial or provocative.
Awesome.
Because they go against even conventional spiritual values. So I want to just prefix a little bit that, so when I was growing up, just so people know, when I was growing up, my parents, I'm ethnically Indian, you know, my parents Indian, but I did not grow up in India. But my parents wanted me to have an arranged marriage. And so I was growing up like in the 80s. So this was in the 80s. My parents were grooming me to have an arranged marriage. Because I'd grown up going to a British school and I was exposed to multicultures, I really didn't want an arranged marriage and I would rebel against it. And just to put it into context for you, I was a huge fan of Cyndi Lauper. And you remember
her
who sang "Girls Just Want to Have Fun"? Yeah. So for those who know her, I mean, I used to emulate her. I used to dress like her. I cut my hair. I had my hair cut short and spiky. And
I think we need some photos of this.
I can send you one.
I would really like that.
And in those days, you could get these hairsprays, which were neon colors for spraying on your hair, which would wash out. But I used to spray my hair like neon green and yellow and pink. And my parents used to freak out. I mean, because there they were trying to get me into an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just imagine trying to get Cyndi Lauper into an arranged marriage. So my poor parents, they were really struggling with me. So one day there was, when we were living in Hong Kong at that time, there was this Indian guru who had huge followers in India. Some people in Hong Kong invited him, flew him down to Hong Kong to come and speak. And one of my dad's friends, who was one of the hosts who was hosting the guru, contacted my dad and said, I can give you a private viewing where you can have a private session with this guru.
Nice.
So my dad jumped at the chance and he said,
thinking I'm gonna rescue my daughter here.
Yes. So he and my mom, they said to me, we're going to take you to see this guru because we want to find out from this guru, you know, we want him to bless you. And gurus usually at that time, there was an assumption that they could not just bless you, but kind of tell you that, are you going to get married? What's wrong with you? And stuff like that. So they were like seers or clairvoyants. And so they wanted to, they said they were going to take me because they want to know, when am I going to get married and what they could do to enhance that.
When's the Cyndi Lauper phase going to pass? That kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. So they take me to see this guru. Now, I want to say here, this is not a blanket statement, does not apply to every guru, but it just so happened in this case with this one guru. What he said to me transformed me, but in a very negative way. So when he looked at me and he saw like that I was wearing Western clothes, nothing wrong with Western clothes, but everybody else there was wearing Indian clothes, which are more modest, you know, with their heads were covered. I wasn't like the typical Indian woman. And immediately he had a lot of judgment about me. And he said to me that And he said to my parents in front of me, with me sitting there, that that I was very spoilt and that unless I changed my ways, that I was not going to get married. And that not only was I not going to get married, he said I wasn't even going to attain nirvana, which for the Western people or the Christian people, that means I wasn't going to get to heaven. And I looked at him and I was really shocked because to me, as a guru, I couldn't understand why he would say that about me because I knew that I wasn't being a lot different from many of my peers. I just didn't fit in with the Indian mold. And I said, but what's wrong with what I'm doing? You know, and I said, you mean there's something fundamentally wrong with me? And he said, yes, until you get rid of your ego, and until you clean all this up, until you cleanse yourself from all this, you are not going to get to nirvana. And I actually said to him, but what's to cleanse? And he looked at me really surprised, and he just said, this, the way you look, the way you're being, you're not obeying your parents. He said, you're not listening to your parents, you're not being a good daughter, and if you will never get to nirvana with all this baggage that you're carrying with you.
Wow.
And it affected me extremely deeply because at that point, that was the first time I truly felt that there was something fundamentally wrong with me. And I want to also add here is that in the culture I grew up in, there was a lot of gender disparity. And so to me, it suddenly meant that I now had to become this subservient Indian woman who agreed to an arranged marriage, who I had to almost give up this identity, this person. But I started to do that because I got so scared that there's something fundamentally wrong with me. And unless I do this, I'm never going to attain nirvana. And I took the words of the guru very, very seriously. And this is why I want to say that what I'm saying is not a generalization against gurus. It was just an experience that I had.
Yeah.
So anyway, I dimmed my light. I made myself small. And that was actually the start of my demise. I made myself so small, dimmed my light so much over the years that I eventually, I would say, I mean, I got cancer. I would say I withered, I died. And it was only upon death did I realize that our purpose for being here is to shine our light as brightly as we can. It is to be who we are. It's not to dim our light. It's not to try and be someone else. And nobody has the right to take that away from you. No teacher, no guru, nobody. A guru or a teacher is supposed to liberate you from the layers that you've accumulated of what is not you. They're supposed to liberate you from that so that you can be you and shine your light. And
When you were on the other side, Anita, could you see how your efforts to be small, your efforts to fit into spaces that other people wanted you to be in or roles that other people wanted you to play, could you see with your expanded perspective how that had impacted your health and well-being and path?
Yes, absolutely. All of those things. And I also could see how traditional spiritual teachings, religious teachings that taught me that the ego is bad, we must suppress the ego, you know, and teachings like a lot of teachings about, in my culture particularly, there was always this gender disparity where everything about me as a woman, we were not allowed to be ambitious, we were not intelligent, strong-minded, independence, all of that, all of those were seen as negative qualities for women because we were being groomed to have an arranged marriage. And so all these qualities made you less attractive for an arranged marriage. So I could see how an Indian guru would say to me what he said to me. Hmm. But I only saw all that in death, that all those things contributed to me dimming my light, making myself small, and becoming somebody I was not. Hmm. And this is where I want to go back to your question about this time that we're living in. And here's where my controversial view comes in. I believe that that there are a lot of people in this world among us who are extremely empathic, they're empaths, extremely sensitive, and they are deeply affected by everything that's happening in the world right now because we absorb it, we feel it in our bodies. You know, people who are extremely sensitive, yeah, that are very disturbed by everything that goes on in the news, and especially here in America with school shootings and, you know, just everything that's going on in the world. But empathic people who are conscious, people who follow spirituality, have always been encouraged to squash their ego. Hmm. And people who are sensitive, they also, because they feel things deeply, they don't like to take limelight. They don't like to take leadership positions. They don't like to stand up and voice their opinions,
yeah,
because they're afraid of the blowback. And what happens is when the sensitive amongst us, when the conscious among us, when the empathic among us are all afraid to take leadership positions, what happens is that the leadership in our world gets taken by the foolish, the narcissistic, and so on.
Wow. Wow. This resonates so deeply. And, you know, I think what you describe or what I'm hearing is kind of a double whammy for the people who are, you know, oftentimes the most sensitive and most in tune. They, you know, many of us or and everyone, you know, people who are listening to this, you know, would be sometimes unconsciously kind of bowled over by their subtle connection to the disparity in the world. So that's one thing, is that, you know, just feeling it and being connected to the challenges that are happening out there. And then two, you know, being taught and kind of groomed that the ego and being strong and being a stand for something and being clear is less evolved or less conscious, and that we have to be humble,
yes,
and just go with the flow. Those two things combined, as you said, we must have extraordinary leaders in the world that are just sitting, hiding in the shadows, you know, not realizing that this is actually your moment.
Yes, exactly. And so I love to talk about this because I want people who are sensitive and kind and conscious and people who are empaths, I want them to know that their voices need to be heard. I want them to embrace their egos. And people are afraid of their egos. So there's so much I can say about this subject. So number one is there's a difference between embracing your ego and being egocentric. Hmm. Egocentric means only being aware of your own ego and not of anything else or anyone else. So the fact that you are constantly questioning yourself and saying, oh, is this egotistical? I better not do this. I don't want to be egotistical, or I better suppress my ego. The fact that you are like that already means you are not egocentric. You are never going to be egocentric. The fact that you question yourself like that means you need to actually embrace your ego more and be unafraid of coming out and being who you are. Mm. That already differentiates you from somebody who is egocentric. Someone who is egocentric wouldn't even question.
They don't ask the question.
They don't ask the question. They just go out there and take over and do things that benefit them.
Huh. Wow. That's a great distinguisher. Really great.
Yeah. So that's what I would want people to know. The other thing I would want people to know is that, unfortunately, being super sensitive, empathic, conscious, is a double-edged sword. And we need to be aware of this. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is we are the ones who are in tune with the universe. We're in tune with with our inner mystic. We're in tune with our purpose. We're in tune with what our guides want us to do. Unfortunately, because we are so sensitive and in tune, we're also in tune with all the noise that's going on outside, from that's coming in from everyone else. Mm. And very often we can't distinguish between the two.
Yeah, right. Wow. Yes, absolutely. And it might even be just a brief encounter with someone at the grocery store, and suddenly we've taken on someone else's viewpoint or someone else's energy or bad mood, and suddenly it's woven into our own reality, and we don't realize that's not ours to begin with.
Yes, and exactly right. And the more we can learn to actually embrace our ego is what helps us to set healthy boundaries. Without an ego, you have no boundaries. That's why the ego is important. Because a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that if you have an ego, you have no conscious awareness. Actually, that is not true. You can have both. You can have a healthy ego and also have strong conscious awareness. But if you have only conscious awareness and no ego, which is the problem a lot of people who follow the spiritual path have, they develop their conscious awareness and they suppress their ego. This is why they need to live in seclusion. They become monks, they become hermits, they live in monasteries, ashrams, and they cannot go out into the real world and take on leadership positions because they've never developed healthy ego, which is what helps them to develop the healthy boundaries. Now, what we're saying, somebody who is egocentric is someone who has no conscious awareness and only an ego. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And the great distinguisher that you said before is we can identify them in some cases by no question of how they're impacting other people or the situation, except are they getting what they want? You know, so there's that.
Yes, the gauge is, am I getting what I want? But there's no question of, am I being too egotistical? There's no question of, am I thinking of other people? Like, that doesn't even arise. But for somebody who is total conscious awareness with no ego, they are usually somebody who is who will be overwhelmed by what's happening in the world and don't know how to live in it, and literally will have to live as a recluse or a hermit or in a monastery or in an ashram and cannot integrate into the world because they haven't developed their ego enough to allow them to really have boundaries, to know where their emotions end and other people's emotions begin.
Yeah. So how do we, at this time, as you're saying, where, you know, true integrated leadership is really, really needed. And you could say that this moment, you know, in one sense, I would imagine one day we'll look back on this moment, this time, we can see that it will have called forth people to rise in ways they never have. But how do we find that middle path and at least take a step towards kind of having the expanded awareness and being strong enough in ourselves and who we know ourselves to be to be a strong leader in action in the world?
Yes, so I have many ideas about that. And first of all, it would be for spiritual teachers to realize that, like if somebody is a spiritual teacher attracts people who are sensitive, who are empaths, who are there because they want to do good, they want to serve people, they'd want to do good in the world. A spiritual teacher is not going to attract narcissists and people like that. So it would be a much bigger service if the spiritual teacher taught their followers how to empower themselves and not to give their power over to the spiritual teacher. Mm. If the spiritual teacher said to the students or the followers or whatever you want to call them, if the spiritual teachers were teaching them, you have to embrace your ego. You have to share your conscious awareness with the world. The world needs you now. The world needs to hear your voice. It needs you now more than ever. You need to step up in leadership positions and open your heart and teach people how to be empaths. How? Because the world is lacking empathy right now, and it needs more of people like you. You need to step up instead of spiritual teachers telling people that you need to squash your ego, you need to go live in an ashram or a monastery. They have to do the opposite of what they've been doing.
And for those, that's awesome.
And also, if I can real quickly add, the reason why spiritual teachers don't say embrace your ego, because everybody has this view that if you embrace your ego, you become egocentric, narcissistic, blah, blah, blah. But those are not the people who are attracted to come and listen to spiritual teachers. You know, in other words, the world is being led by the people that we don't necessarily want. I mean, there are many, many, many well-qualified, spiritual, empathic people who could lead the world, but they don't, because they don't want to get in the fray. So they need to be encouraged. They need to be strengthened. They need to be motivated. They need to be told that it is the spiritual thing to do. And they need to know it's not unspiritual to step up and take leadership positions.
So for those listening and those who will listen in days and weeks to come, whether they're associated with a teacher or not, but they're in this moment where they can feel a restlessness, and maybe it's come from an overwhelming overwhelming stimulus to their, sense of empathy that they haven't known what to do with, or, but some desire to move forward powerfully and kind of embrace their ego, as they said. What's a step? What can we do to kind of turn the heat up on our light, turn the dimmer up a bit? And how do we know when that's starting to happen?
Well, encourage people to, first of all, embrace the fact, it's about awareness of who you are. Embrace the fact that you are somebody who is sensitive. You are somebody who feels things, who feels energies, who feels the people around you. Embrace that fact. Embrace it. Get to know yourself as that person and be comfortable with that, and don't judge it. Don't judge yourself. I mean, and that's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do is, the thing about people who are super sensitive and empathic, they seem to be really good at giving of their energies, dimming their light, making them small, they practically disappear. They give and give, but they're not good at receiving. In fact, they're terrible at receiving. So I would say check how you are at receiving and start making a commitment to open up to receiving. Mm-hmm. As you open up to receiving, it actually starts to energize you. It makes you feel bigger. It starts to It starts to brighten your own light. And when I say that, open up to receiving, I mean, even if it's not receiving something that someone else is giving you, open up to doing things for yourself and don't feel guilty about taking the time out to care for yourself, to whether it's spending time in a long bath or watching the movie you've been wanting to watch but felt you didn't have time, or reading the book. It's got to be something you don't normally do, but get used to starting to take care of yourself, because it's important that you take care of this vehicle and energize this vehicle that is your body if you really want to make a change in the world from the inside out. But you want to impact the world, but you also want to take care of yourself. Because here's what you want to do. You want to change the world, but you don't want to take a drained or angry or stressful self out into the world, because that's what you will share with the world.
Yeah.
You want to take somebody who is healthy, who's strong, who's at peace within themselves, someone who loves themselves. And what happens is if you're willing to go out and be seen because you've embraced your ego and you're willing to go out into the world and be seen, your very presence changes the world. It literally is. It's just your presence that can change the people around you.
Hmm. That's such a powerful thing to anchor in and really take in, you know, so much, particularly in this world. We think that it's what I do, you know, it's that achievement that I get or that accomplishment or that actually has the impact. But we forget that just showing up, just being there, just being who we are actually has a ripple effect that we must way underestimate that.
We really do way underestimate our presence because we are all connected. And this is something that will never leave me, is that knowledge that I experienced when I was in the other realm, is that when I was without my body, I could feel every single person's emotion. I mean, everybody, all my family who were around my physical body, I could feel the emotions they were feeling as though they were mine. I could feel the doctors as though they were mine. And it hit me that we don't place enough importance on it. I mean, we talk about it in energy healing and things like that. But in actuality, you walk into a room, you can change the energy of the whole room. So are you bringing in something positive or negative? So if you want to light up a room, you have to be a bright light and you don't even have to say a word. And what is a bright light? Somebody who just has very strong positive energy, someone who has embraced who they are and who knows they're here for good, who knows they're here with a purpose and who knows that they're loved. And they just have to walk into a room and they can change the energy in a room.
Yeah, wow. I love that. And I guess when we think about, you know, many of the great teachers that we, you know, that we hold in such high esteem, you know, the prophets and teachers from the ages, it's not really the stuff that they did that we remember or that we hear about or that we read about. It's actually who they were that we connect with and resonate with. So even I would imagine, you know, even at that level, that's really what they were bringing was their presence.
That's exactly right. They were bringing their presence. Exactly.
And, Anita, you mentioned before that if you start to get unwell or if you start to kind of, feel, you know, sick or have symptoms or that sort of thing now, you know, where you used to maybe chase the symptoms and, you know, triple down on all the supplements and stuff. Now, you said you asked a few questions around, you know, what you're saying yes to or what you're kind of giving out there that maybe you don't really feel called to. Could you come back to that a little bit? Because I think it sort of ties powerfully to what you just shared.
Absolutely. So actually recently somebody asked me the question that what would I, like knowing what I know now, how would I deal with something like cancer? And in fact, I just had the flu a couple of weeks ago and I dealt with it the same way. So let's do a comparison. So back then when I got cancer, the first thing is, okay, there's this fear. And the first thing I would do is look at treatment options, everything from conventional to naturopathic, to, you know, and you want to know everything. And I would research everything. And I wanted to take everything that was an anti-cancer supplement. And I was ordering everything and trying everything and reading up on everything, researching everything. So everything was about putting this stuff into my body to try and get rid of the cancer. So you've got the stress of having the illness, and then you're adding to that stress by trying to figure out how to get rid of this illness by researching all this. And then there's the stress of, is this working? Is this better for me or that? And like, I was so confused as to what supplements to take because there were so many different supplements. There were so many different modalities, whether it was traditional Chinese medicine or Ayurveda or Western naturopathy, or whether to follow some of the different diets, like there's the the raw vegan diet and where you completely detox, or whether to do the conventional chemo and radiation. And so you get really confused and really fearful as to whether you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. So you've got the fear of the cancer, you've got the confusion and obsession of the research and getting everything, and then the fear of whether you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. Now, today, knowing what I know today, I would do the complete opposite. If I'm dealing with an illness, it's not about what am I going to do to get rid of it. It's about what am I going to let go of in my life so that I can release more energy, so that my body has more energy to heal whatever is happening. Because illness is a manifestation of something else in your life. Illness is a manifestation of whatever it is, the accumulation of the fears, the stress, the lack of self-love, whatever it is that's accumulated and brings you to the point of you get this wake-up call of an illness. So as it is, my physical body is stressed, it got an illness, and now I'm adding to the stress with the whole let's look for a treatment, blah, blah, blah. But when you realize that your physical body is ill because of what you've been doing, you want to actually let go and stop doing what you've been doing. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So I want to do the opposite. So the first thing I do is definitely not about the treatments or whatever. That is the second or third thing I do. The first thing is, okay, what have I been taking on in my life that's been stressing me out? What have I been saying yes to that should have been a no? What have I been taking that's not mine or doing that's not mine? Where have I been being somebody who everyone else wants me to be? You know, and for some people, it could be that they've been in a relationship that they that they don't want to be in, but were afraid to admit it, or they're in a job that they hate. So it could be a difficult situation. So the first thing would be to, what can I let go of? What can I let go of? What can I let go of? The second thing would be, now, how can I take care of myself, nurture myself? Shall I sleep more? Shall I take more naps? Shall I eat healthier food? You know, how can I take care of myself? The third thing,
which is a very different question. Yeah. Then, you know,
yes.
What treatment do I need to take? You know, that's great.
Yeah, it's a very different. And then the third one would be the treatment, just to maybe it's just to give my body that push towards healing. But healing does not come from the treatment. Healing comes from the first step and also from the second step. But the first step is realizing, what have I taken on that's not mine? What can I let go of? What have I been saying yes to that I should have said no? That is where the real healing comes from.
So awesome. Anita Morjani, such a delight and a deep pleasure connecting with you. And there's several tributaries opened up that I want to dive into and extend this conversation for another 3 or 4 hours. We've probably taken enough time for today. Any closing thoughts? One quote that stood out to me that I've heard you share is this notion that, you know, God isn't a being, but a state of being. You know, any closing remarks for us, each of us, the listeners out there who are ready to step into a greater state of being, who are ready to step up to their leadership in a new way, and just looking for, you know, what's my first step? What's my next step?
That's beautiful. So I would want everybody to know that we all have access to that state of being of God. And your first step is to let go of whatever is not you. And I just want to leave you with a Michelangelo quote, which actually, where Michelangelo said something like, you know, when somebody asked him, how did he carve this beautiful statue of an angel from this rock? And he said, the angel was always there. I just chipped away at what was not angel and set it free. And we are all God. All of us are God. But we just have to let go of what is not God, what is not us, and set ourselves free.
Thank you so much for being who you are and being such a great window into the possible, an invitation for each of us to access greater aspects of ourselves.
Oh, thank you. It's always such a pleasure and honor to talk to you, Chip.
We've been speaking with Anita Morjani, the New York Times bestselling author of Dying to Be Me. We hope you've gleaned some potent insight into your relationship with your ego today and to your path of purpose in life. To find out more about Anita and her upcoming events, experiences, and beautiful work in the world, visit her website at anitamorjani.com. And that's all from the Uplift Podcast for today. A big thank you to Anita for sharing your time, energy, and deep wisdom with us, and to the Uplift team for pulling this episode together. For more inspiring stories and courageous conversations in many forms, be sure to subscribe to the Uplift Podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thanks for choosing to be here with us on the ever-evolving journey of Uplift. I'm Chip Richards, and I look forward to being here with you next time.